Yes, I was very much interested in who Sohan Lal was and what does he think about these songs which are sampling his voice, and is he being compensated for them? Where is he now? What is he doing now?
Welcome to Zetnopod. On the microphone, Tanja Luchsinger, and in the chair opposite me, here in my office in Oerlikon, we have Chris McGuinness. Chris is a PhD candidate in ethnomusicology at the Graduate Center at the City University of New York. He teaches anthropology courses in Switzerland, and he's also a musician. Welcome, Chris. Chris, you and your work caught my attention last year at a meeting here at the department. During these meetings, we usually share and comment on each other's academic work. And one day, you presented something that started with a fascinating anecdote. It was about a snippet of music often heard in pop songs, whose singer you tracked down all the way to rural India. And would you mind retelling this anecdote, maybe as an entrance into your research?
Hi, Tanya. Thank you so much for having me here. It's really a pleasure to participate in this podcast and the academic life of Switzerland. The singer that you mentioned before, I actually heard recently when I was in Coop at Zug Station. There was a pop song that came on and that singer's voice was in the pop song. And it just occurred to me that wherever I go in the world, I never really get away from this voice. And now I'm talking about it. So the singer's name is Sohan Lal. And the voice was on a sample library. A sample library is basically a collection of sounds that musicians and producers can use in their own works, and they may or may not have to pay royalties to the library company. And this particular sample library was released during the 1990s. This was a library that was all about Indian sounds. So these are some of the sounds that were in that library.
I actually know some of these songs.
Those are just a few samples from the sample library that were used in some pretty well-known songs, but there are many other samples. The sample that I heard of this voice is really interesting because rappers and electronic musicians and rock bands have, in one way or another, used this voice. And often it sounds like this is a singer who's part of that song rather than an electronic sample. So that's actually created a lot of controversy on the internet when people who've heard one song accuse another song of copying or sampling or plagiarizing the other one. Let me play you this voice.
This sounds so beautiful and really powerful as well.
Some of the listeners might have heard this voice before, maybe not. The lyrics that you just heard go something along the lines of, I've fallen in love with one who does not care. My beloved's home is on the other side of the stream. I have given my word and must go. And it's actually a folk tale, which is quite common in North India, as well as the border of India and Pakistan in an area called Punjab. And this type of story, it's about the trials and tribulations of someone who tries to meet their lover. It's also a metaphor for religious devotion. So these are types of stories which have existed for a long time in folk poetry and in folk songs. But the sample itself was used in a lot of different contexts. So these are some examples. This is from 2003. This is another example from 2007. So that was MIA, and the producer was Timbaland. And this is a singer named Anastasia. This is the song which was actually playing here in Switzerland.
Sunlight, Okay, it's fascinating. So I know most of these songs, but I've never really noticed that there's the same piece of music everywhere in all of these songs. It's incredibly interesting to listen to it like that. So when this snippet of music has been following you again and again, what did you do with it afterwards? Because somehow it didn't let you go, but it made you trace it even further. Could you tell us something about that?
Sure. So I contacted some of the musicians who made songs using this sample, and I interviewed some of them and also learned many interesting things about how they related to the sample in different ways and why they used it. But I also wanted to see what other songs used the sample. So I thought, okay, why don't I try using Shazam? And Shazam is a song identification application. So rather than Shazamming a song, I Shazammed the sample library itself. And interestingly, every time I Shazammed the samples, it would give me a different result. And I just kept finding more and more songs through Shazam. I began to wonder about the singer himself, the person who sang the sample, and if this person knew about the sample, if they received compensation for the sample. And it also reminded me of other very famous samples by artists who were never really compensated for their work. So a couple of examples. Solomon Linda. And it also reminded me of the Winston's drummer, Gregory Coleman. So both of these artists in their lifetimes were never really compensated for their work, or even maybe understood the magnitude of influence that their recording had.
Okay, by now, even I am so curious to know more about this singer, about this person whose voice is featured everywhere. So I'm wondering, did you track him down? Did you manage to find him? What happened next?
Yes, I was very much interested in who Sohan Lal was and what does he think about these songs which are sampling his voice, and is he being compensated for them? Where is he now? What is he doing now? Well, it turned out that he had passed away during the early 2000s, but I was still able to track down his family members. And I went to Jalandhar, the city in which they live in Punjab, India. But when I got there, the family wasn't home. So I waited in the city for a couple of days and I visited the Dargah, which is the Sufi shrine where Sohan Lal would perform. And I learned about the history of the poetry that Sohan Lal was singing. I met and interviewed Gulshan, Sohan's son, who is also a Sufi musician. And during our interview, I played the samples of his father for him from the sample library. And Gulshan started to sing along. And it was a way for him to reconnect with his father, who he had been separated from for so long. So Gulshan and I discussed the poetry, and I also asked him about the process of recording the sample, and he described to me that two foreigners had come to their village and recorded his father as well as other musicians, and that they had not received compensation. Interestingly, Sohan Lal's granddaughters, who are the Nuran sisters, are very well-known folk musicians, and even today they sing in front of very large audiences and perform the kafi that their grandfather also sang.
Even upon hearing the anecdote the second time, I'm still very intrigued by it. And I'm still so surprised that you actually managed to trace this voice the way you did. One topic that really comes out pretty prominent in everything you've told us so far is the issue of authorship. Like, whom does a certain recording belong to? Who can use it? Who should become royalties? Who shouldn't? And you also mentioned a certain controversy at some point. How was it for you? Like, after following this snippet of music for so long, what were the questions around authorship that you thought about or that followed you?
Yeah, so in this particular instance, the controversy was what got me into the project to begin with, because I was in a studio in Mumbai and someone was playing some samples that we might use on our remix. And I was like, oh, I know that from this song. And then I realized that it might have been in other songs. So the controversy of the sample also was interesting because the style of poetry that was used in the sample also didn't have clear authorship. And the idea of ownership for the people who were composing this poetry was actually very different from the idea of ownership which we would typically have today with digital media, because the creation of these poems is actually a form of discovery, that a person is discovering the divine beauty of the world and God's truth in the world. Often what we find is that many poems are attributed to a singular person, and in this case it's the poet Bulay Shah.
I'm also wondering, isn't authorship changing a bit, especially in the field of electronic music, where different snippets from different places are being remixed, mixed together, overlayered, and so on? Isn't the idea of authorship already changing in some way?
Thank you. That's a very interesting question. And it relates to something which interests me in my research, which is why music producers are interested in these samples in the first place. The sample libraries often present the samples as being exotic, as being of a different place, as being something which the producers can explore. So I think that for many music producers, using these samples is a form of discovery, it's a form of exploration, and it's a form of imagining. Through consuming these sample libraries, producers are able to imagine new uses of these sounds as they experience them in their exploration, including Sohan Lal's voice. Really, there's so many different use cases. Sometimes producers are interested in just the sound that they perceive, the texture, the timbre of the voice. But other times, just the foreignness of the voice is something that is interesting for them to signify.
Somehow I'm reminded of something you brought up back then in this discussion at our institute, when you talked about the fact that Sohan Lal has passed away, but still his voice is being worked with, new things are created with it, like more discoveries going on. And back then you talked about this interaction between the dead and the living, yeah, within the sphere of music, basically.
The question about dead and alive, it's quite interesting. There are two ethnomusicologists, Ben Pickett and Jason Staniak, and they've written an article called Technologies of the Intermundane. Intermundane means between life and death. And what they talk about in their article is how technologies are used to mediate dead voices in the living world, and how even though a musician may have expired, their catalog continues to generate capital. What they talk about is how technologies can be used in different ways to manipulate audio in order for those works to continue to exist and even have a sort of agency, meaning that those works from the past can have some sort of say in the present. And another way that Sohan Lal has agency is if we think about what the song actually is. These poems are still being performed by other people. This is part of a broader pattern of incorporating poetry under one name. And these poems are performed by other Sufi poets. And even Sohan Lal's granddaughters, the Nuran sisters, are performing this kind of poetry. So the poetry itself has a kind of agency in terms of who performs it going forward, who they perform it for, what happens as a result of that.
So it's like a continuous history. So actually Sohan Lal was only one little figure in this continuous history of this poem, basically. So I feel that so far you have like taken us on this very fascinating journey, like back to Punjab, like tracing Sohan Lal and his voice, back to this reflection about authorship. But I think it's time for us also to understand a little bit how it happened that you started to research this topic, sample libraries, Indian musicians. And it would be interesting to hear a little bit about your path, like what led you to get here and do this particular work that you're doing.
I came across the sample that we were just talking about long before I ever studied it. And that's because I was working as a music producer in India. I got to India somewhat randomly. I went there on a short trip in the 2000s, and I ended up meeting some DJs and music producers. So my skills were of interest to them. And before I knew it, I was producing music for Bollywood movies and making remixes and DJing around Asia. That was really fun. It was exciting. I was working on songs and learning as I was going, even though I didn't understand so much about them. But really, once I was traveling a lot, I started to explore the countryside and villages and really get to see what life was like outside of the city and city environments that I had been accustomed to. And what was really exciting about that for me in terms of music was that I had grown up with music as being sort of a commodity, something that you could own. And what I noticed in villages was that folk music was something that belonged to the community. And it wasn't just a thing that people did for entertainment, even though sometimes it was, but it was also a way that people equated with their surroundings. It was a way for people to understand their environment. They used it for farming. So when the rains would happen, they would have to sing songs for the rains. And the way the world played out had to happen through the way that songs were sung. The two couldn't exist without one another. And this was really exciting for me, not just because it was a different way of thinking about the world that we live in, but also, could songs be used to change the world? So me and a friend of mine who's a rapper, Delhi Sultanate, we started a group and we traveled around India to work on projects with people who lived in rural India. And it was a way for us to explore the way that people lived and wanted to transform their surroundings through our musical abilities. So we would go to different places and I'd bring my whole electronic music setup in my backpack and we would somehow plug it in somewhere and maybe using batteries or lots of extension cords. And we would record on site local singers and we would interview them, also research the history of the place and do farming and all kinds of activities in those places.
But this was all long before you got into any kind of academics, right? This was happening before that.
I didn't know that what I was doing was actually ethnography. I didn't even know there was a word called ethnography. So yeah, it was long before, but it was through this work, through making music and making documentary films, I really started to question a lot of the things that I was doing. We started to question a lot of the things that we were doing. We almost canceled entire projects that we had been working on because we felt that we were not doing justice representing the people that were involved and the places that we were visiting. So a lot of questions about exploitation and looting and just, do we really understand what's going on? Do we understand them? How are we portraying them? All these kinds of questions raised significant problems just in the music that we were making. What kind of music? How is the music representing this? What is the story that's being told? That was a major motivator for me to try to study these things. And then I took an anthropology class. And then my anthropology professor told me I should do a PhD, and then I ended up doing an ethnomusicology PhD. Ethnomusicology is more or less anthropology of music. So ethnomusicologists do ethnography and interview people, they observe people. In many parts of the world, music is really a very prominent modality through which people experience their world and express themselves. And music is so crucial in how people understand their religious identity, in how people protest and organize themselves. Music is a way of connecting people in space, coordinating people through rhythm, through engaging people's emotions. So music works on so many different levels. It tells stories. It has words. It becomes a focal point for groups of people to identify with one another. So this is what I ended up studying.
Maybe for our listeners who are now very fascinated by either ethnomusicology or by studying protest songs in India, by sample libraries, whatever it might be, do you have any literature tips of books that speak to similar things that you are working on that people could read if they want to find out more?
Sure. Well, there's so many great monographs in ethnomusicology. And one of the classic ones, I think it was written during the 1980s, that I like is called How Suya Sing by an author named Anthony Seeger. The book doesn't actually use the word music that much. It's about how people in this particular Amazonian community sing and vocalize as a way of manifesting the world. All right, so the other book that I would recommend is a book written by my advisor, Peter Emanuel, and it's called Cassette Culture. And it's really about how when cassettes were introduced in India during the 1980s, the entire music industry changed as local regional industries emerged, and there were new cultural changes in India just through new technologies for disseminating music.
And this sounds interesting. Even I feel like reading some of these books now. We are nearing the end of our podcast. Is there anything left that you really would have liked to say, or any topic that didn't come up but you would have liked to say something to it? Then this would be the time.
Since we're on the topic of ethnomusicology, I think it's worth pointing out that two of the most famous ethnomusicologists are actually from Switzerland. One is Hugo Zemp, and Hugo Zemp worked in the Solomon Islands during the 1970s. Another one is Regula Qureshi. She did very important work about Islamic sound and music practices in Pakistan and India and around South Asia. So they're both from Switzerland. And in North America, they're some of the most elite ethnomusicologists. So it's cool to rep them here, right?
I definitely agree. Thank you so much for joining us for this podcast episode. Chris McGuinness here with Zetnopod.